podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
United, they fall. Hello and welcome to episode 2 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week, it's not only one up top, but I'm handing out a debut cap as well. That means leading the line, and wearing the captain's armband, is Tom Aberdee. Tom, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I hope all is well.
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. I'm glad the Premier League is back. We've had a debut show last week for season 5, so that was sort of setting the ground for this week, and now we've got some proper football to talk about, and you are in the right place to help me, I hope.
Well, I'll try my best.
That's all I asked, Tom. That's all I asked. Before you do your best, though, I best do the social media bits. Otherwise, we'll be talking into the abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being Spirita.com. For all the tips and predictions you'll ever need, visit their website. And the easiest way to find me is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast, put a dot between the R and the E, you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. Where should we go first? Let's go to Manchester. And for those fans who are hoping for a new era at Old Trafford, things have certainly not gone to plan as yet for Erik ten Hag. Tom, does Sunday's defeat at Brighton, or so I say to Brighton, highlight just how much work is going to be required for the Red Devils?
Well, I mean, I'll put a caveat right here and there that I am a United fan.
Excellent.
And that this will have a strong opinion about it. I think you've got to take into balance that, firstly, Brighton were immense. I mean, you just I've loved Brighton's way of playing for the last few years. It's been, you know, good football. Potter's a great manager, and there's always been great signings. But I think they mastered the plan, because Ten Hag said after the game he was not expecting long balls, which obviously is going to be an issue for Martinez, which we'll get to a little bit after. But they just exploited that so much and so well that I think United were all over the place. That being said, you know, you think back 10 years, you know, I started watching Man United 15 years ago or so. Old Trafford was a fortress. You'd never be able to play this kind of football at, you know, at Old Trafford. You get rolled over and everyone would start to sort of, you know, park the bus to be able to play against United. The fact that teams, I mean, no disrespect to Brighton, it's not exactly Manchester City now coming to Old Trafford. So expecting them to play so high was not something that you would see even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. So that's also the first element of it. But obviously United were, I'm not going to say the word atrocious, but it's the fault is there. The fault really is there. There were so many issues, especially at the back. Maguire has not quite settled in yet. You know, it's the first time he's changed over from left side to the right side since... Well, I mean, I've not watched him a lot when he was playing at Hull, but I imagine it's at least until Sheffield, maybe even Hull years, that he was playing on the right side of a centre-back partnership. So having to shift over is the first element, and it was sloppy all over. And when you still have McFred in the midfield, you got to wonder where the hell is the transfer business. So it's it was shambolic. I don't think Ronaldo brought that much either. The fact that we got a goal is very lucky. I felt bad for Sanchez, who actually did try and save that goal, and it still went off his teammate. So, yeah, there's a lot to change. There's a lot of work. I'm patient. I hope a lot of United fans will be patient, because Ten Hag is a fantastic manager. I've watched him over the last few years in the Netherlands. But it's not by playing... McTominay and Fred in midfield that we're going to be able to bring this club forward and into what we hope is something similar to what Ajax was doing over the last few seasons. So maybe it's signings, maybe it's the choice of personnel starting, you know, thinking to Van de Beek, for example, who was, you know, interesting when he came on. So, yeah, there's lots of work to do. I am being patient. It is obviously frustrating because there's hope, but it is frustrating to see that the first game of the season is just, if not as bad, maybe even worse than the way we ended the season.
Well, let's take that 4-0 defeat to Brighton as a reference point, because there's no doubt that during the last few weeks of the season, last time round, United were going through the motions. And that happens under a caretaker or an interim manager. The season had already ended. So that Brighton result at the Amex was an absolute disaster. So you're sort of hoping that with Ten Hag in charge, it's a fresh start. You know, you get the 3 points, we get underway. Who knows what happens in the season. But even in those first 45 minutes, it felt like you were still going through the motions under the old management. And it's kind of like nothing new had changed. So yes, you had Martinez at the back, but Christian Eriksen looked a bit devoid in the middle of the pitch as well. A bit light up front. You had Fernandes spearing that chance over the bowl when he should have really scored. So is that the concern, that it just didn't feel very different?
Well, I mean, you've got to be patient with this. You know, it's sort of like, I'm not saying it's as much of a revolution, but it's sort of bringing in someone like Van Gaal into a club. You've got to, you take even City, you know, City were not perfect when Pep came in, not in the first few weeks. They didn't sort of install that kind of winning mentality, that playing style. And Ten Hag has done so well over a few months. And he was, I think, as much as I do believe in Ten Hag, and this will caveat the whole thing, but he came into Ajax with, firstly, a structure where Ajax have played this football before. You know, before him, there was Bosch. There was obviously, there's the whole lineage of history of playing total football and possession football. While at United, those players haven't been exposed to that kind of playing style over the last few seasons. You think back to Van Gaal, maybe the last time we really had that kind of possession football. But even thinking back, you know, Sir Alex was never really a possession type of football. It was just, you know, really electric speed, counter-attacking type of football, solid in midfield, dominating and so on. So realistically, no one at the club, even in the academy, has known how to play the Ten Hag way or the Cruyff way or whatever you want to call it. So you need to be patient with that extent and sort of think, well, it's not with one game or three preseason games against Melbourne or a depleted Crystal Palace that you're going to be able to get that sort of playing style installed. You also have to think that Eriksen was starting up front. Now, Eriksen was, I think, probably the less worst player on the United side.
I think that's fair.
And, you know, it's incredible to see him, even if it's 10 years late, to see him finding a United shirt. You know, you sort of think Eriksen should have joined the club in 2013 when everyone thought he was going to join. But it's good to see him, you know, at this level. You know, you obviously think back to the whole Euro situation. So it's good to see him there. He has that sort of Ten Hag mentality and a playing style in him, but he needs players around him. And I'm seeing McTominay play at point centre forward is some of the it's the worst thing I've seen in United shirts since Fellaini was playing up front. And Fellaini knew how to do it, not McTominay. So while McTominay has been pretty good in points, especially in the Solskjaer, for example, in a six role, he is not a centre forward. So there's some players that need to understand that, firstly, they're not at the level to be at this club. And secondly, they shouldn't be moving around this much. As much as Ten Hag is probably asking this, there's certain players who just can't control the football. And they shouldn't be playing up front and trying to be the target man. So I am hoping for, you know, Ronaldo to come back into form if he stays, or if we finally get a top-notch Anthony Martial to start up front. Now, that's a whole different ballgame because we've seen it during preseason. As much as preseason is not an actual season, you know, seeing him combine with Rashford and Sancho was a lot more exciting than what we saw this weekend. So there's a lot to work on. Choice of personnel is the first one. Players upping their game. And even, you know, just thinking to the leaders in this team, you know, De Gea was terrible. Maguire was terrible. Who else is supposedly a leader in here? Not really anyone else, because there's a lot of, you know, younger players. Shaw is not a young player anymore, but he's not exactly a leader because he's not played as much as everyone else because of injuries. But there supposedly are leaders on this pitch. And so when you bring on Ronaldo, you expect him to lead the line, bring his teammates back into play and say, guys, let's pull the socks up and, you know, go for it. But no, he was sulky on the pitch. He doesn't want to be there. That's the way it is. But he's sort of supposed to be slightly more professional and trying to help the team. So, yeah, I wasn't surprised. It was obviously disappointing. We're really looking forward to this, but it's not that much of a surprise that it will take weeks, maybe even the full season, as much as it's been a transition season ever since Sir Alex has left. But I think we need to be patient and give Ten Hag time with his staff to bring that ethnos and ethos, sorry, work ethos into the club and sort of make it work together.
Well, in terms of the attack, if Cristiano Ronaldo is creating a big question at the moment, is Marcus Rashford the answer? Because he seems to be back in favour during pre-season, and you're right, you can only sort of take too much weight from pre-season fixtures and results. But he didn't have a great game himself, Rashford, on Sunday. And that's kind of been, again, the progression of what happened last season. Yes, there was injuries as well. But are you confident in Marcus Rashford to lead the line? Can he get you goals that you need this season? Or are you going to have to go and try and get someone else in the market before it shuts?
I think, ultimately, Rashford has become a wide forward. And that's what he's always been. And I don't see him leading the line. I would say we trust Martial again, which is weird, because it worked well with Rashford and Sancho. And if he's fully trusted, he can do well if he's, you know, safe of injuries. I would still keep Ronaldo, however, and probably still have him trying to remotivate him and say, you know, lead the line with the young players and maybe add another trophy, which would be the Europa League, to your cabinet. And that might motivate him, but it's like, that we see him leave.
Okay, let's go to Saturday lunchtime now and Craven Cottage, as Liverpool could only manage a draw at Fulham. Now, Tom, it is only week one of the season, but when you consider how dominant City are likely to be this time around, is that already 2 points dropped?
It is 2 points dropped. We've seen over the last three or four years, basically, that these two teams have battled out until the final day, basically, for points, and that usually Liverpool actually are missing one or two points. And so unless they're going to win both games against City, which wasn't the case last year, they drew both of them, then they're going to need to catch up on games that City might, you know, draw or lose. City will draw games. And not necessarily against the teams we expect, you know, Chelsea or and so on. City usually do drop points against lower sides. You think Crystal Palace last year, for example. So it is 2 points dropped, but I think that's not the main issue in this game. I think it's Liverpool's level and the things they showed against a promoted side was slightly more worrying than actually dropping points.
Well, after the game, Jurgen Klopp was very quick to offer up another excuse. This time, the pitch was too dry. Now, do you think there's anything in that, or is he using this as another smokescreen for Liverpool's overall performance?
I just want to show off the amazing community manager of Fulham Twitter account, who said how lush the pitch looked with the you know, the water coming onto the pitch. So it was a good dig at Jurgen, who always finds the greatest excuses. You know, I do respect Jurgen Klopp. I think he's a fantastic manager, but sometimes in front of the press, it is a bit worrying, the type of things that you can come up with to try and excuse what his team was doing, because ultimately, as much as he might say that it's a dry pitch and so on, he didn't actually have that much of the ball from memory. It seems like Palinha, Andreas Pereira and all that stuff, they all combined so well and actually had more of the ball than was expected, and by far and large dominated quite a good part of the game. Which is definitely not the fault of the pitch, but more of structure and, you know, Jordan Henderson not being in 200%. We've seen since that Thiago is injured and out for 6 weeks. And he was out of his game. He was just not there. You know, he lost about five or six balls in the first half hour, which hasn't happened. You know, you'd think to try and combine four or five games to try and see him lose that many balls in the same amount of minutes. So there was worrying shades there. I think Darwin's Nunez introduction at halftime was a good choice. He was obviously going to come out at some point and did very well to score. Also missed a chance, but you know that's the way the cookie crumbles. But yeah, there's worrying sights. I think defensively it's still shaky. I don't know why nobody recognizes that Mr. Trent Alexander-Arnold is not the best defender in the league. He is a fantastic passer and can get loads of assists. But defensively, he's always caught off guard. And Virgil has not come back. You know, fighting with Mitrovic is not an easy task, but it seemed like he was very far from his best level of 2 years ago. So there's going to be, not necessarily changes, but I think Jurgen needs to try and find ways to remotivate the squad, work harder at training, and try and say, yes, you are predicted to be in the top two this season, and we have a new centre forward. But we're not going to get there by just laying back and just relying on individual brilliance from Salah. Darwin Nunez seemingly is going to fit in pretty well. But, you know, change of Mane to Darwin Nunez is a different style. And when, you know, you think the leaders like Firmino, Van Dijk, who weren't on top-notch performances this weekend, you think those are the players that need to step up to be sure that Liverpool do keep on fighting for that league title, for the Champions League, for the Cup, and so on. So there needs to be a remotivation, a way to try and push this group a bit forward and say, don't rely so much on your individual brilliance and what you've known in the past. This is not necessarily a new era, but there is a new chapter with Haaland coming in and City being more efficient, even more efficient in front of goal. So they're going to have to push themselves even further. And I'm sure he can do that. He's got a fantastic staff as well to do that. But he needs to do it very soon, because otherwise Liverpool are just going to stroll into games like Fulham mid-afternoon on the weekend before a Champions League game, for example, and thinking already the Champions League game, even if it's, you know, I don't know, they get Tiraspol or something in their group, they'll probably be thinking about European nights. And that's where they lose points. That's also where City would lose points. But I think something needs to change in mentality. And we've seen it over the last few seasons that Liverpool have sort of trailed off. As much as they've been brilliant and have fought for the title right till the end, there are moments where they rely a bit too much on individual brilliance from Salah, notably, rather than a strong collective, which was their force in 2019, for example.
In terms of the flashpoint of the game at Craven Cottage, it was the penalty award in the second half. You mentioned Van Dijk and not being as sharp as he was 2 seasons ago. I'd say 2 seasons ago, he doesn't make that error. He's not flat-footed. He's not caught out.
Nope.
In terms of the decision itself, would you have given the penalty?
I would have. I think, firstly, other than just the decision, I always say, and this happens a lot with my French club, Lyon, if you put yourself in a position where you're relying on referee's decision to win a game, then you've not done enough outside of that decision to win the game. And when you think of Liverpool going to Craven Cottage, surely it's not just a penalty that's going to upheave a result. So they should have done better outside of it. But the decision itself, I think Van Dijk's put himself in a position where the referee can blow its whistle, his whistle. And so that's obviously going to happen now with VAR. So as much as the Premier League doesn't blow the whistle for penalties as much as other leagues, that was always going to happen, especially with a tall guy like Mitrovic. So it's not a good look on Van Dijk for sure.
Well, in terms of Mitrovic, a brace to get his Premier League account underway after an exceptional season in the Championship. Yes, it's a step up, but he makes that step up scoring goals straight away. So for me, he looks leaner, sharper. I mean, his all-round ball control was brilliant on Saturday. How integral is he going to be in trying to keep Fulham up this season?
Oh, he's obviously, you know, a star man. Other than being, you know, a lovable character and you know, a fan favourite, I think he's the goals and the source of victories and points for Fulham. Two goals against Liverpool is not easy feat, even if there's a penalty. But I, you know, as much as there's a good talent in the squad, you know, I really enjoy seeing Polina in the Premier League, and Andreas Pereira get another chance, another crack at it. He's the only real source of goals. And, you know, there's some good wingers, but they're not goal scoring wingers. Harry Wilson was that last year, to an extent. Does he bring that back again? Maybe. But Mitrovic is the real source of goals, and Fulham are gonna need at least 15 from him this season, if not 20, to stay up. Because I don't see where else the goals are gonna come from. They're gonna need a solid defense, but he's the star man. He's loved by every fan. He's the sort of big teddy bear of Craven Cottage, but he needs to keep that winning mentality, that Serbian energy, and fight for the end, right until the end of the season, because Fulham are going to need him to survive.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in the sense that Fulham, in their last Premier League appearance, they were giving, what, 2 goals a game on average as a head start almost. So if you're giving away two,
Absolutely.
you need to score three. Mitrovic wasn't at it really last time around 2 seasons ago. So you kind of need to get more out of him while giving away less at the back. If they can get the balance more geared towards attack rather than defence, they might just be all right. And Matthew, a Fulham fan who was on the show last week, was a little bit frustrated with,
Concerned.
concerned with the business which had taken place thus far. It's kind of, he rightly said that Fulham were what promoted by March, April, really. The succession planning for this season should have happened then. They've been a bit quiet, and you wonder about the likes of Forest who've done their business. It might just sort of cause damage for Fulham at the same time. So it's going to be interesting for Fulham. I know they bought Bernd Leno as well to go between the sticks, although he was on the bench on Saturday. So there is still time for business, but you also do sense that it might also be a missed opportunity if they don't.
Well, you do think back to not the last time, but the previous time when they bought in, what, 15 players or something with Andreas Schurrle and so on. So maybe there's that element of we don't want to bring in too many players. But I did talk to Jack Collins, who's a host on the Ranks FC podcast and the Fulhamish podcast as well, a few weeks ago. And he told me it's not so much buying lots of players, because a lot of positions in this team needed an improvement, especially if someone like Nico Williams is going to leave anyway. But it's a question of actually getting them signed and on not necessarily long-term deals, but actually like 2 or 3 years, rather than having them always on loan, because they're always there's a there was a you know tendency for Fulham to get a lot of loans to come in and get players to get lots of money and sort of get a nice occasion to play 1 year in London and play some lovely football in Craven Cottage. But realistically, they weren't pushing themselves for the club survival, because they would be fine by playing, you know, Schürrle was loaned over from Dortmund, from my memory. So he's probably fine by going back to Dortmund afterwards. So you need players who are actually committed to the cause and keeping the club up in the Premier League. And hopefully they're going to start doing that a bit more. I think they've done very well with Polina and Andreas Pereira. Bert Leno, we have to see what his level is after 2 years basically without playing since Ramsdale's arrived. I think it's a solid addition, but there's more needed, especially in defence, to avoid, as you said earlier, those 2 goal advantage given from the get-go.
Well, let's talk about another 2 goal advantage now, one at the London Stadium, because who else but Erling Haaland got a brace on Sunday. 2 shots on target for City, 2 goals, maximum efficiency. And I guess, Tom, as debut performances go, they're not going to get too much better in the Premier League, are they?
No, they're not. As much as there were some small mistakes and so on, and you know his, I guess his official debut for the club was the Community Shield, and he didn't do too well in that, did he? I think he was definitely better. He was on target. He did great runs. That the run he did to get the penalty was pretty good for himself. And the second goal, obviously, it is just prime Haaland. You know, you think. Where if it's on the other side, it's sort of the Thierry Henry finish, if you see what I mean. It's sort of like that opening up of the shoulders, getting around the keeper and finishing it off. But the run itself, I mean, as much as the ball played to him is exceptional, the diagonal run is great. So he's shown exactly what he can do. And obviously there was a worry that the defences in the UK and the Premier League might be less open as they would be in Germany, and he might have less space in the back. Well, seemingly West Ham, as soon as they start pushing a bit forward, well, they were going to get caught off guard behind. So I don't think we're going to have as many compact defences as people would say. But I think that was a brilliant debut. Seemingly has fitted in well in the collective. Teammates seems to love him. Jack Grealish said a lot of good things about him after the game. So it's all going sort of smoothly for him. Obviously, the main worry for Haaland was not necessarily adapting to the Premier League. It was more staying fit throughout the season. That we can't say after a first game. But it's going to be exciting to follow this season. And I'm sure a lot of FPL players will be delighted to have Haaland scoring this weekend.
Yes, they certainly were. I know I was, although I made the mistake of not making him captain, but you live and learn.
Ah, who did you have?
I had Kane, but I think that was my own Tottenham bias. So, but I think my logic is always go for a home captain, but then I completely forgot about Erling Haaland. So we'll see. We'll make the switch for week two. I'm not going to be that silly second time around. But in terms of Haaland, though, you mentioned injury. That's the only thing that's going to sort of scupper him, because we know he's the real deal. It's just been a case of him waiting to get into the Premier League, and already in week one, he's hit the ground running. There's no doubt about that. So let's say injuries don't make a sort of big detriment to his season. How many goals do you reckon he can land for Man City in the Premier League?
Well, before the Premier League actually started, I think it's Quarker who asked hot takes for the Premier League. And my hot take was that neither Haaland or Nunez would finish top scorer.
Interesting.
I think Salah would again, or Son. Son, again, we'll talk about Spurs later on, but I'm sure that the attacking power of Spurs will give Son loads of opportunities to score lots of goals, and he stays more fit than Haaland. I do think he's going to break at least the 20-goal mark, because he's on penalties as well. And while Sterling is not there to dive anymore to get penalties, City do get a lot of penalties somehow. So he's going to score at least, I'd say, 6 or 7 penalties this season. And he's going to get a good, you know, I'd say 12, 15 goals in open play at least. So I'm averaging around the you know, 23, 25 mark. Because there was a lot of goals around him at City. However, I think in the years to come, there is a chance that if Pep does stay as manager, he will adapt his team to suit better Haaland and make him more of a focal point than having, you know, Ilkay Gundogan or Grealish or Bernardo Silva scoring goals, and having just him score the 30-odd goal in the season, with Mahrez dropping down a bit more and having more assists than goals. But Pep never gives the full keys to a new signing in the first season. So I think we've got to temper expectations for the first year and, you know, expect 15 open play goals, which would be great for a first season in the Premier League, let's be honest.
Yeah, I think 25 is about par in terms of total goals this season. And you're absolutely right in the sense that Haaland at the moment fits in. The jigsaw is sort of, that's the missing piece already. But the jigsaw shape might change with Haaland at the top of it. And then with City having the kind of goal spread of about, what, 6 players, you can easily chip in with at least 8 or 9 per season. And then obviously your bigger names have much more. But there's a supporting cast who are more than capable of chipping in with their own goals. But that might subside and Haaland takes more of the burden on his shoulders. But City don't drop a step at the same time. So you're right in the sense that let's just kind of see where Haaland does, where he goes this season. But 2-3 years down the line, if he's still there, assuming he doesn't go to Real Madrid and Pep's still there, then I guess we're in for even more City dominance. Great, he says. But in terms of West Ham, their defeat obviously far from ideal when it comes to starting the season. Is the saving grace with David Moyes here that they've got one of the hardest games out of the season out of the way already, that they can just kind of dust that one off and really the season starts this weekend?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, obviously City is never an easy one, as much as West Ham has, from my very selective memory, has done okay against City over the last 5, 6, 7 years. Got a few draws here and there.
Yeah.
Played brilliantly, I think, at the London Stadium last year, if I'm correct. Yeah, it's a tough one to start the season, but someone had to do it. You know, you say Fulham, for example, started the season with Liverpool. I'm sure they're delighted with 2 points, with 1 point, sorry. It's a tough one, and I'm sure Moyes is not delighted to lose Fabianski as much as Ariel is a brilliant keeper. Losing Fabianski on the first game of the season is not great. They've missed out most likely on the signing of Onana from Lille as well.
Yeah, that's gonna, that's complete now. Everton have got him.
Is that complete for Everton?
Yeah.
Okay, that's you know, as a, from a French perspective, I can tell you he's a brilliant player. Is he worth 40 million euros? I don't think so, but you know, that's the Premier League. There's always unlimited money there. But they've missed out there, so maybe, you know, there's always that fear at West Ham that Declan Rice gets a serious injury. And with Mark Noble out of the you know, sort of equation, who comes in really to replace him, not only numerically on the pitch, because Dushek can do that, but quality-wise, who's going to replace Declan Rice if he goes out for injury for a few, even a, two or three games, but maybe even longer. So that's a real worry. I will say this, signing Scamacca and having a backup to Antonio, as much as I think Scamacca will surpass him at some point this season, is good, because being too reliant on Antonio and possible injuries is not a good thing for West Ham. So Scamacca hopefully hits the ground running for them very soon, and they can start properly the season next week.
Okay, let's stay in London now, because Tottenham, they got the better of Southampton. Now, the Saints drew first blood, but in the end, you'd have to say it was nothing more than an emphatic win for the hosts.
I think emphatic is a perfect word for it. I still do have high hopes for Southampton this year, as much as a lot of people are saying they might drop, but I'm sure we'll get to that after. Spurs were, you know, a bit slow to start off, sort of diesel engine type of thing. They got a bit surprised by the goal, but you know, it was poor defending. Happens to everyone. Happens quite often to Emerson Royal, however, so I'm glad they brought in a speedster like Jed Spence on the right side. But ultimately, I mean, that the team is incredible. The fact that you can leave all of the signings, such as Risarlison, Bissouma, and so on, onto the bench shows how good the starting 11 is. You know, that front three was probably the best front three in the Premier League since Kulusevski arrived from Italy. So ultimately, it was not a surprise to see them overturn it, especially at home. Scoring four goals was, I think, actually a minimum. I think Saints got away with it. They could have scored maybe five, six, seven, eight, you know. They did put off the foot of the accelerator the latter parts of the game. But ultimately, it was a, you know, classic Spurs 2022. You know, Conte has really reshaped the team in his image. It's high pressure, lots of creativity, creating a lot of chances, and Kane looks back in form again. So I have high expectations for Spurs this year. If everyone can keep on performing, maybe they bring in another centre back. I think that might be the issue, especially in squad depth. But ultimately, it's a fantastic squad, and that front three would scare anyone in the United Kingdom and probably Europe, actually.
Well, let's talk about the third part of that attacking trio, that being Dejan Kulusevski. Now, Harry Kane rarely scores in August, and before, as a Spurs fan, I and many others would be quite concerned. Now, though, our Ginger Swede can take on that burden for himself and not only score goals, make them as well. So how important is he going to be to Spurs' hopes of success this season?
Oh, he's going to be tremendous, super important. Obviously, Richarlison, to an extent, Perisic as well, can play up front, have been brought in to bring more depth and alternatives to Conte. I'm sure if he keeps on pushing his players like he did in Korea, there's going to be a lot of very tired legs by the time the World Cup comes and goes. So rotation could be crucial. However, I think if you can play Dejan Kulusevski throughout the whole season, I think you should. He's a fantastic player. Has got a knife for goal, but also a great eye for a fantastic ball. Combines very well with his wing backs usually. I'm hoping to see Jed Spence come in and play a lot this season. Not sure I'm a huge fan of Emerson Royal to that extent, but there is talent, and he's got the energy and the understanding, and somehow perfectly works with Conte. You know, it seems like they've always worked together. So hats off to him, hats off to Conte for bringing him in. I'm sure Patrici had a great role in that as well. with his role at Juventus before. But yeah, no, play him as often as you can. He's one of the very best, I'd say the top three right wingers in the Premier League. So you're lucky to have him.
We are, really. I mean, in the sense of a January signing, it didn't get too many pulses racing. It was a welcome addition because we certainly needed bodies up top, but it was a case of, oh, okay, well, but he just completely hit the ground running. And in that kind of last couple of months, he was just the difference, really, between Tottenham finishing fifth and fourth. So all credit to him, and also all credit to Conte with the miracles he's working at the moment. Staying on him, though, how do you reckon Tottenham will fare come the end of the season? Do you think they'll go as far as perhaps splitting Man City and Liverpool, or will they still be a step off the title pace?
Splitting, do you mean we'll go right till the end?
So let's say the title challenge? They, you know how it's been City, Liverpool, top two for a number of years now. Could you see Tottenham being top two? Not getting their hands on the trophy, but let's say finishing above Liverpool and behind City.
I think they'll fight for it. I think they'll be the closest one. They're pretty much a definite top three.
Right.
It really depends on whether Klopp can really get that motivation back into his squad again. If Liverpool play like they did on this weekend throughout the whole season, Spurs can beat them. I don't think they're quite on the level that City is. But it'll be intriguing because we've had obviously the same two teams for the last few seasons, and maybe City leave off a bit of the pace in the latter part to focus on actually winning the Champions League this time. But who knows whether Spurs can do another great run in the Champions League as well. So I think will they split it? I'd say probably no, but will they be closer than they did last year? That's definite. I think it'll be under 10 points difference with Liverpool, which is already a great progress. But yeah, they're the most likely to be fighting to split those teams, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think when you look at the distance between Man City, Liverpool and Tottenham last season, it was quite seismic. So to get within 10 is certainly progress. Yes, it probably needs a lack of progress from Liverpool, but we'll take it all the same. And I think also you must remember that Tottenham did beat City twice last season in the Premier League, once under Nuno, which is perhaps more of a fluke, but we have got City's number if we need it. So I think for Tottenham, it's more a sense of consistency elsewhere. The drop points that we were having at the beginning of the season, more defeats more than drop points, actually. So hopefully they're a thing of the past. And I feel that where we've had Man City, Liverpool, and then four teams chasing after two other Champions League invites, I feel it could be Tottenham are kind of getting clear of the chasing pack. And then you've got, Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United, and maybe one other fighting for those Champions League spots that are last going spare. I guess the race for fourth is now a little bit more intense, but now only has, say, three teams contending for it.
For sure. I mean, as I said, Spurs is the most likely team to go and split that. I'm sure we'll discuss Chelsea, which I have to tamper my beliefs in, I think, this year. But when you see how atrocious United were, who really is going to be that fourth team? Well, I think it's going to be your rival from North London. I think it's pretty clear from the... Obviously, don't make conclusions from the first game of the season, but if I had to decide today, I think it'd be Spurs and Arsenal, the other two in Champions League next year.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that, to be honest. But before we focus a bit more on Tottenham's two London rivals, let's go back to the team they beat on Saturday. My notes say that if you are a Saints supporter, you might be a bit concerned, but you're not really sharing that. Do you feel it's going to be a difficult season on the South Coast? Can Hasenhüttl last the distance? Is he under pressure? What do you make of the things going on at St Mary's?
Well, I mean, I seemingly am lot less concerned than a lot of people. Obviously, Saints fans will probably know better than I do. I follow Southampton maybe every other week. And The Athletic have all said that Southampton are one of the, not favourites, but contenders to relegation. So maybe I'm being too optimistic and that the signings of Lavia, for example, excites me a bit too much. But he is a fantastic player from the rare things I've seen from the academy level. And, him and Joe Aribo are great additions to the squad. But is Hasenhüttl the right man for the job? You know, you'd think after two, after losing twice 9-0 and also adding, you know, 10 defeats in the last 13 games or something of the season, surely that's something where the new management, you know, the new investors at Southampton should have said, why don't we give this a chance to change? Why don't we obviously bring in new players? Very interesting. Sikumara as well coming in from France. All great signings, and I think they've done very well on that side. But I don't know if Hasenhüttl has it in him. Other than just having it in him, it's sort of like, you know, let's take an example from France again. PSG, once they lost that famous game in Barcelona, it was sort of chasing the ghost. It was getting all the players that were involved in that team and the management and so on to try and evade that memory and try and do a sweep clean and try to restart from there and progress. You'd think drastic changes are needed to Southampton after those 9-0 defeats and those 10 defeats at the end of the season. Surely you start with the manager because it's not just a one-off, clearly. It's a few games in a row where it's not quite good enough, and to progress under new management and to progress under the new investors, something needs to change. And as much as I've believed in Hasenhüttl and he's done well in the Red Bull system, he's clearly not the right man for the job. And I think a lot of Saints fans will agree with me. As much as he's a seemingly a lovely character, you know, that those tears after winning against Liverpool were maybe put on for show, but also probably genuine, actually. The waistcoat is brilliant. All that stuff is brilliant. But is it good enough to bring the team forward and say, hey, guys, why don't we try and aim for the top half of the table this season rather than just struggling for relegation? So I would have changed the manager this year. I don't think they should do it anytime soon. But he, with, you know, let's say Frank Lampard, for example, or Thomas Frank, are amongst the three or five managers that are in danger at the start of the season.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with that. Whether Hasenhüttl might be the first man to be sacked this season, I don't know. It might be the case that Southampton change their manager and then stay up rather than Hasenhüttl keeping them up. But you mentioned Frank Lampard, so let's go to Everton next, actually, because it was clear they lacked firepower on Saturday as they lost 1-0 to Chelsea. Had they had a striker, who knows? But then again, this is Everton. So not only are they lacking firepower, they're lacking defenders now. Ben Godfrey out for 3 months, but they have signed Connor Cody. So what do you make of his arrival from Wolves?
Well, that's a shock to me. I've just learned it now. That shows how much I follow it. I guess that's a really good signing. Him and Tarkowski in middle, that's an interesting partnership. Not the most, you know, flashy of partnerships, but definitely a very solid one that knows the Premier League and can do well. I am surprised he would leave Wolves, who seemingly are in progression this year, but maybe need a new challenge. And let's be honest, who really wants to live in Wolverhampton? So maybe he needed a new chapter of his life, and he wanted to play under Frank Lampard. So as an improvement for the defence, it's a shame that Godfrey is out. But I think the real issue is going to be, you know, up front. As much as they brought in, seemingly Onana has been signed, losing Richarlison has not been replaced, and I don't see Demarai Gray having the same impact as Richarlison did. It was interesting to see Iwobi play as a sort of a roaming eight in midfield. I don't think that was the worst decision in the world, but there needs to be consistency, more leaders to bring them forward and say, guys, let's pull our socks up and do better than this. I think the pressure is on Frank Lampard's shoulders. Everyone is tipping him to be the first manager to go, and I wouldn't be surprised if he goes by October. You know, if they take, let's say, 5 points until then, that's not going to be any good enough to stay up. So they were very lucky last year. You know, additions of Van de Beek and still having Richarlison and the return of Calvert-Lewin as well was really helpful. But if you have to rely on Dele Alli and a very injury-prone Calvert-Lewin, you're not going to go very far this year. So maybe an attacking threat is much needed at Everton.
I think you're right there. In terms of Chelsea, though, they weren't at their best, but I don't think they needed to be at their best on Saturday. What's your early assessment of the Blues this season?
I think seemingly it's similar to I would have said about Liverpool. There needs to be a regroup and a remotivation to push themselves forward. Obviously, last year was a bit underwhelming. The whole Lukaku episode was not great. They've now sold Werner as well. But Koulibaly is a great addition. Sterling is a great addition. There's some interesting players. Kukurea was a bit of a surprise to see him there. I don't think he's necessarily in the right club. Clearly, there's an issue with left back at Manchester City if Cancelo moves back to the other side. But Chelsea need to improve to stay in that top four. They're not going to be as good as Arsenal and Spurs if they stay at this level. Obviously, players need to settle in. Koulibaly needs to settle in as well. Sterling needs to be more of a focal point, and I don't think he has been that focal point at City over the last few years. Obviously, there's been so many great players around him, and with City, it's, I guess, more of a collective element than just a bunch of individuals. So it seems like he's going to have to lead the line a bit more in the blue shirt, in the navy blue shirt. Yeah. I do believe that Borja is going to play quite a good role this season. I think he's a fantastic player. Did really well at Southampton last year. Brings something different to Havertz, who's a bit too skinny to be a target man. But alternating both strikers is going to be good, and not having the poor mentality or sulky Lukaku is going to be better for the club. Will they be better than last year? I don't think so. I think Tuchel needs to find a way to remotivate them and get them back onto the right track. But as you said, they didn't have to be at the best to win this game, and they scraped it out. But it seems like it's been the case for the last few 18 months, basically, since they won the Champions League, that it's near 1-0 wins with a Jorginho penalty. Seems like it's not the first time we've heard that one.
It certainly isn't. I think in terms of Chelsea, Sterling is a exciting signing. I guess it's their marquee signing. But there's kind of a lack of plan B there, isn't there? All the strikers, mm-hmm. all the forwards seem to be interchangeable. The likes of Mount, Pulisic, Ziyech, Sterling, Havertz. Yes, you mentioned Armando Broja, which I guess now with Timo Werner going back to RB Leipzig, he's gone right up the food chain in terms of forwards. So he'll be their plan B, whether he's really enough to really push Chelsea into fourth, third, who knows. But I still feel they're one more needed up top. And I don't think that, well, I don't know actually, whether they need to change their mentality of who they sign, because we all know that Chelsea is a graveyard for centre-forwards. So maybe they might be better off not signing centre-forwards. Maybe they've gone the right direction with Sterling. But even with that, I still feel he's not quite the answer. It's not quite the square peg in the square hole, if that makes sense. It's a little bit out of shape, but we'll see. You know, what do I know? I'm not someone who's won the Champions League before, so we'll see how it pans out. But hopefully it doesn't click on Sunday when Chelsea meet Tottenham, and Arsenal will be hoping, I guess, that they both draw, because they won on Friday. They got the Premier League underway against Crystal Palace. Not only did they win, they got revenge for their 3-0 reverse at Selhurst Park last season. So when you compare the two sides, Tom, I guess it's quite simple to say it's a different Arsenal side. Is it a better Arsenal side?
It was a fantastic not trailer, but fantastic poster match for the Premier League, at least the first half. Opening the season with that type of game, the intensity, we've all seen Gabriel Jesus play pretty well and for City over the last few years. He's been moved out wide over the last few months. But the dribbling, the directness, the drive forward, I'd not seen that kind of, putting it on his shoulders and taking responsibility in his own hands from Jesus over the last few years. So it was really good to see. I think people undermine how good Martinelli can be up front if ever he needs to change up. Odegaard was brilliant again. Saka, as usual, consistent. Obviously, as a Spurs fan, I don't know how much bias you have against Arsenal, but I do have to say they look a lot more solid this year, especially if someone like Tomiyasu comes back in a right back, because I think that's maybe the one flaw we saw with this game is Ben White's playing wide. I think there is a chance that we see Saliba and Gabriel play the whole season as centre backs, and Ben White being sort of third choice with Tomiyasu coming back in. So there's a big improvement. I still feel there's a sort of midfielder missing, like a top-notch one, because Shaq and Partey are good, but not incredible. They do bring experience to this very young side. But I would have said, you know, someone really solid in his prime years to bring this team forward and be a bit more creative and solid defensively as well. That's a good sign to make for Arsenal to finish off a great window, I think.
Yeah, it pains me to say nice things about Arsenal. They are certainly looking better in terms of personnel, more depth, but you're absolutely right. I feel that if there is one weakness at the moment, it is the centre of midfield, because Shaka's always good for a booking or a red card, and those disciplinary issues have a habit of cropping up. Partey, his mind sort of goes from time to time. He's never quite on it all the time. So there is a deficiency there in the centre of midfield. I think that's what might cost them in terms of really getting a title tilt underway. But I feel the Champions League football is still a very realistic possibility for the red half off North London. But let's go to two promoted teams now. First up, Bournemouth, Tom. Scott Parker was bemoaning his club's fortunes in the transfer market before Saturday, but he would have not been bemoaning the Cherries' fortunes after an impressive win over Aston Villa.
Yeah, I mean, I know that everyone is sort of hyping up Villa over the last few weeks. You know, there's an interesting article from One Football saying, are they challengers for Europe? I think not. It's not just on this game. I think it's based on Watkins dropping off, Ings dropping off, defensively not that solid, as much as they've recruited well with Diego Carlos. It's not quite a Villa side that's expected to get into the Conference League or even Europa League. So it's not as much of a shock result as I thought it would be. But I did tip Bournemouth to be one of the first ones to go back down. So hats off to them. The Cherries have brought back a result. Lerma still playing very well. It's a solid team, you know, having Billing and Solanke and sort of in the same 10 square meters is must be difficult for a short player to come in. But it's going to be interesting to see what Scott Parker can do. Obviously, the last time he was a manager in the Premier League, I guess, was last season or two seasons ago with Fulham. That didn't go too well. So interesting to see what he can do. But I do think there needs to be more additions to the squad. Otherwise, they're not going to survive anytime soon.
Well, Nottingham Forest have made plenty of additions to their squad. They had no fortune on Saturday, though, as they lost to Newcastle. So for Stevie Cooper's men, have they gone the other way? You mentioned Fulham when they came to the Premier League two seasons ago and bought loads of players. Is this going to be a help or a hindrance at the City Ground?
I think the key signings that they've made, I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name properly, Awoniyi, or whatever his name is. From Union Berlin, was fantastic in Germany, and that's a really shocking transfer for every Bundesliga fan to say, why is he going to a promoted side while Union Berlin are still, you know, fighting for Europe and so on. But I guess, you know, money does drive in the Premier League. So it's a fantastic signing. Jesse Lingard, if you can get him running again and have a good, you know, DJ in the dressing room, sure, why not? Having Jesse Lingard around is always a positive. I'm sure West Ham would have liked to have him again. And Dean Henderson is a great keeper. You know, when people compared the first goal that Brighton scored against United to one of Dean Henderson's saves, and clearly he's outdoing what De Gea is able to do these days. So I'm sure he'll be back at United and starting next season. But it's another great one for him. The rest, you know, it's interesting signings without being sensational. Omar Richards is an interesting one. Nyakate in centre back as well is a good one. I think overall they have improved the squad, and there's no doubt about it. Losing their hero Samba was a bit of a sad one, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. But Yeah, you do wonder how 12 players are supposed to settle in. I will say this, they did sign all of them basically end of June, mid-July. So they've had plenty of time to get to know everyone, to settle in. I'm sure the City Ground must be boiling these days and ready for action very soon. So who knows how it's going to crumble, but some people are tipping them to go straight back down. Other people are tipping them to be the surprise of the season, a bit like Brentford last year. So anywhere can go with a promoted side, and Steve Cooper is going to be a big, big responsible has big responsibility there. I'm sure a lot of people are delighted to see Nottingham back into the Premier League, and definitely don't want to see them drop back down for another 20 years.
Well, Wolves, they're going to also look to solve their attacking issues by signing Gonçalo Guedes. I believe that's over the line, actually. So they lost 2-1 to Leeds on Saturday. They went ahead. Now, Wolves certainly struggled for goals last season. There's no doubt about that. I think it was 38. That's an average of a goal a game. Now, the defence wasn't too bad, but towards the end of the season, they really went off the boil. Their European hopes diminished. They kind of hit the skids in, what, April, and the season dissipated into nothing. So are they going to be in for a tough campaign this time around? You get the feeling they kind of missed their chance to really break the glass ceiling. Are they now in the group competing with the likes of West Ham, Newcastle, Leicester? Is top half viable, or will they miss out?
I think it's another hot take I have here for Leicester. I don't expect a big season from Leicester. So are they in the mix with, as you said, Brighton, Newcastle? I don't think so. I think Wolves have an interesting squad, but Fabio Silva has left, at least on loan, if I'm correct. And Gonçalo Guedes is a fantastic signing, but it's another Portuguese. It's going to settle in well, but how much is Guedes going to bring to the Premier League? Who knows? If they're relying just on him for goals, going to be a difficult season. Podence, seemingly everyone has figured out how to stop him, unlike Jota, for example. And losing Connor Cody, I mean, I'm still in shock that that's actually happened. Is going to be a tough one. Ike Nwori was clearly off the. Off the beat this weekend, and it's going to need a solid defense if they're not going to score that many goals. So they're going to need to recruit up front. I think they're going to go for Ujo from Bordeaux as well, possibly a centre forward who's a good signing, but does he get you 15 goals in a Premier League?
No.
Probably not. So recruitment needs to be done, and I'm sure Mendes is going to be able to bring out some sort of young Portuguese star to settle in there as well. So I'd argue they're more likely to be 13th than in the top 10.
Yeah, I'll make you right, to be honest. I mean, I saw one very hot take that they'd get relegated. I don't think it'll come to
Oh,
that.
wow.
Yes, a boiling hot take. But I feel there must be some frustration if you're a Wolves fan that they've now become this conveyor belt of talent, haven't they? That they now just, the model seems to be young Portuguese in, see what we can do, move them on, profit. Now, if it works, if you want to be just a Premier League team, there's no danger in that, that's absolutely fine. But they've not cracked it yet, and I feel that now with the likes of Newcastle and West Ham knocking on the top six door, that Wolves are going to sort of struggle, and now they are going to be just comfortably mid-table, and I don't see where the progress comes from if all they're ever going to do is buy young Portuguese players. But I guess that's a quandary for them to solve and not us. Because finally, Tom, before we wrap up, Leicester, you just mentioned your feelings on them for the season. A 2-0 lead at home to Brentford turned into a 2-2 draw by the end of it. Where's it continually going wrong at the King Power?
I don't know. I think Tielemans clearly isn't quite what he was, and I think it's the same argument that I would make with Wolves is if you're number eight, in the case of Wolves, it's Neves. If they either leave or not in form, then the whole team doesn't quite work. Vardy's obviously aging, so that's not been quite replaced as much as there's been recruitment as there. Dewsbury Hall is interesting, but there's nothing sensational and surprising about this team anymore. Brendan Rodgers has been figured out for many months, many years, and doesn't seem to want to reinvent himself to push himself forward. As you said, if Leicester want to be just a regular Premier League side, which is, if you look at their history, pretty good. But if you look at their recent history, if you look at, obviously the title and playing in Europe, then they're very far from that. So something needs to improve, maybe more recruitment, Fofana needs to get back into shape. Obviously, he's just come somewhat back from injury, so give him a bit of time. But you know, when you're leading 2-0 to Brentford, those are the type of results that you need to stay in the top half of the table. Obviously, I can't predict that every team is going to finish in the second half of the table. That's not how tables work. But I would put probably Leicester in the second part of the table, along with, you know, the Aston Villas and the Wolverhamptons. So who really is pushing upwards? I don't know. It seems like there's a plethora of and a group of teams that have diminished over the last few months and haven't done very well in the transfer window. So there could be a disappointing season for quite a few teams there.
Yes, I mean, I don't think Leicester, again, they're going to struggle with relegation, but considering they've
No.
knocked on the Champions League door, what, twice and then not got let in, and then they kind of fell away again last season across the whole campaign, maybe top half is still a good season, I don't know. But again, I worry for Brendan Rodgers in terms of, I mentioned to Matthew last week actually, that in the sense that last season everyone spoke about credit in the bank, winning the FA Cup, getting them into Europe and having that long European run. But now I don't think he can rely on that, and if Leicester do get off to a bad start, the chopping board might be him. Well, might be prepared for him as well, actually. So something to consider, him and Southampton. But of course, what do we know? We could get that completely wrong, and they could have great seasons. So,
Oh, they might.
yes. But of course, that's just week one. There's 37 more to go, and we've hit full time in this one. So to do the admin, very, very simple. Tom, thanks for your time this afternoon, wearing the captain's armband. More importantly, I hope you enjoyed it, and like to come back soon.
I did. I absolutely loved doing this. It's getting back into the Premier League and going through all the teams is always really interesting. And I guess I also get my transfer business done with Connor Cody.
There you go, you get some live exclusives as well, so you can't say fairer than that, can you?
Nope.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy, this is The Real Football Cast, and until next time, goodbye.
Podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network.